You'd like to be turning to Galatians chapter 3. We're going to be there shortly. We can get discouraged in a Christian life. What we do today is to go back some 1900 years to look at the rise of Christianity, to try to get some idea about why there was such great success in the rise of Christianity, and then try to apply that to us today. It is a fact that Christianity is either of divine origin or it is not. And if it isn't of divine origin, then it has to be of human origin. And if it's of human origin, then it is a false religion, because it claims to be from God. But on the other hand, if Christianity is of God, as it claims, there ought to be compelling evidence to affirm that it is from God. In this lesson this morning, I want us to focus in on a few factors which argue for the divine origin of the religious system founded by Jesus Christ. I want us to look at some of the factors involved in the rise of Christianity. There are nine traits that characterized primitive Christianity that demand an explanation if one is to identify its originating force. Let's consider some of these. Christianity, an unknown religion. The Christian movement was not a religious system that gradually evolved out of the cultural elements of society. It had a dramatic point of beginning. There are no traces of Christianity in either Assyria, Babylon, Egypt, Greece, or Rome. Prior to the spring of AD 30 or so, Christianity simply did not exist. It had been in a state of preparation for more than 3 years, and these 3 years spanned the ministries of John the Baptizer and Jesus of Nazareth. As a matter of fact, even though the Mosaic system was designed to prepare the way for the coming of Christianity, the religion of Jesus was so strikingly different from the Jewish that it aroused the hostility of the Jews. We talked about that in Bible class this morning. For the first 40 years of its existence until the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. Let's look in Galatians chapter 3 about how the Mosaic system was designed to prepare the way for Christianity. In verses 24 and 25. But before faith came, we were kept under guard by the law, kept for the faith which would afterward be revealed. Therefore, the law was our tutor to bring us to Christ, that we might be justified by faith. But after faith has come, we are no longer under a tutor. From the time of its beginning, however, Christianity was a significant religious force, not only in the Mediterranean world, but also in the remote corners of the Roman Empire. Seemingly, for some reason, Christianity appeared from nowhere, and yet, very quickly, it was everywhere. How did that happen? A fundamental logical principle proclaims that every effect must have an adequate cause. What is the cause behind the Christian religion? There has to be a reasonable explanation for the abrupt beginning of this movement. And it is true that if no satisfactory answer can be found in the natural world, then we must look to a supernatural cause as an explanation. One of the other factors that we need to look at in the rise of Christianity. Point number two is an unlikely reaction to Christianity. For some reason, the religion of Christ exploded in the first century. Jesus only had a handful of men, the apostles, and from this tiny group came the Christian movement. On the day of its birth, the community of believers consisted of at least 3,000 people, Acts chapter 2 and verse 41. If this number, 3,000, only included those that were immersed on the day of Pentecost, then that's all there was. But perhaps there was more than that because of the disciples that had been baptized by John the Baptizer and the Lord's disciples. If it is the case that it was 3,000 on that day, then it was significantly larger. Not long after that, the number of saints was computed at about 5,000 adult men, Acts chapter 4 and verse 4. Not to mention the thousands and thousands of women and others who were added to the church. It has been estimated that by the time Stephen was martyred in Acts chapter 7 and verse 60, that the Jerusalem church consisted of no fewer than 20,000 people. And what's amazing about that is that the population of Jerusalem at that time is estimated to be only 55,000. So over a third of the people in the center of the Jewish religion were Christians by that time. And beyond that, beyond Jerusalem, the gospel spread rapidly from Palestine into Africa, Acts chapter 8, into Syria, Acts chapter 9, into Asia Minor, Acts chapter 13, and finally in Acts chapter 16, into Europe. Paul, whose missionary journeys have been computed to equal over 12,000 miles, evangelized from Jerusalem to Rome and perhaps even to Spain. Clement of Rome says that Paul reached the boundary of the West, which could be an allusion to Spain. Both Irenaeus and Tertullian confirmed the presence of Christians in Spain in the 2nd century AD. Christianity swept over the Roman Empire like a tidal wave. The New Testament pays tribute to this phenomenal growth. The Christians were charged with having turned the world upside down, Acts chapter 17 and 6. Their sound went out unto all the earth, Romans chapter 10 and verse 18, and was bearing fruit everywhere, Colossians chapter 1 and verse 6. Historian Will Durant argued that by AD 300, a quarter of the Eastern Roman Empire was Christian and about 1/20 of the Western part of the empire. It has been noted that studies of the catacombs beneath the city of Rome, which there are about 600 miles of these, contain somewhere between 1.75 million and 4 million Christian graves. Now understand that by that time there were some of these that probably weren't Christians as far as pure Christianity is concerned. It's estimated that in the Middle Empire at least 20% of Rome's population was made up of Christians. And at times the percentages were even greater than that. The catacombs represent approximately 10 generations of believers. Now let me tell you the significance of that. What that means is this: that the city of Rome itself, the center of all humanity at that time, had somewhere between 175,000 to 400,000 Christians at any given time during those 10 generations. The testimony of the historian Tertullian is most dramatic. He says, "Men proclaim that the state is beset with us. Every age, condition, and rank is coming over to us. We are only of yesterday, meaning we just recently began, but already we fill the world. We need to remember that this phenomenal growth was achieved under the most adverse of circumstances. Again, the question cries out for an answer. What was the cause for this amazing growth? What natural circumstances can account for that? We must also remember, when we're thinking about the rise of Christianity, that the initial impact of Christianity was among who? The Jews. Many thousands and thousands of Jews were converted to Christianity, and it is an indisputable historical fact that the Jews were strictly monotheistic. To them, there was only one deity, and yet, without controversy, is the fact that Jesus made claim while he was alive to being divine. John 5:18, John 8:58. Surely, one of the strongest sort of evidence, such strong sort of evidence, would be necessary to persuade a Jewish mind to acknowledge that that humble Nazarene was God. John chapter 20 and verse 28. Point number three in looking at the rise of Christianity is an unlikely place of origin. We need to think about where Christianity took its rise. This movement was established in the city of Jerusalem, in at what that time was a rather obscure country called Palestine. Palestine in the first century hardly merited any kind of attention. It was only about 150 miles from north to south, from Jaffa to Jericho, east to west. It's only about 45 miles. It encompassed about the same land mass as the state of Massachusetts. So we're not talking about a big place. In 63 BC, the Roman commander Pompey conquered Jerusalem and the Jews came under the rule of Rome. The Jews of the first century were a dangerous people. We talked about this in studying in the book of Acts. In AD 49 or 50, Claudius Caesar expelled 20,000 of them from Rome. We read about that in Acts chapter 18 and verse 2. The Jews had a disillusioned expectation of a political Messiah who would overthrow the rule of Rome, John chapter 6 and verse 15, and then establish a reign reminiscent of David. There were in the area of Palestine at this time these men that we talked about there in the book of Acts that the Lysias thought that Paul was the head of. These were a band of cutthroats, literally dagger men named the Sicarii, who roamed the land looking for Romans to kill. You see, Palestine, not only was it small, but it was a dangerous place. It was ready to ignite at any time. Is it possible that any ordinary man seeking to establish purely a spiritual regime, John chapter 18, verse 36, could possibly be successful in such a volatile environment? The point is this. It was a time of extreme unrest, and Canaan was an unlikely place from which to produce the world's most influential religion. How did, therefore, such a powerful force derive from such a humble and troubled background? Are there natural reasons that could explain that? Our next point, talking about the rise of Christianity, is that it had an unlikely leader. Jesus Christ, viewed as a leader from purely humanistic vantage point, possessed none of the traits normally associated with the formation of armies or empires. He was not physically appealing. He has no stately form or majesty that we should look upon Him, nor appearance that we should be attracted to Him. Isaiah 53, verse 2. There is not a single line in the books of the New Testament speaking about His physical appearance. Napoleon said this about Jesus Christ. I know men, and I tell you that Jesus Christ is not a man. Superficial minds see a resemblance between Christ and the founders of empires and the gods of other religions. That semblance does not exist. There is between Christianity and any other religion the distance of infinity. Alexander, Caesar, Charlemagne, and myself founded empires. But upon what did we rest the creations of our genius? Upon force. Jesus Christ alone founded His empire upon love. And at this hour, millions of men would die for Him. Jesus had no wealth to launch a significant movement. We read about that in Luke chapter 9, verse 58. He had nothing. He was reared in one of the most despised communities of His country. Turn over to Matthew chapter 2, verse 23. And He came and dwelt in a city called Nazareth, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophets, He shall be called a Nazarene. Now look over to John chapter 1. Verse 46. And Nathanael came to Him, said to Him, can anything good come out of Nazareth? Philip said to Him, come and see. Now turn over to John chapter 7. Verse 52. They answered and said to Him, are you also from Galilee? Search and look, for no prophet has arisen out of Galilee. Christ had no formal training to be a leader. Even His own people had little regard for Him. And yet somehow, He changed the world forever. The following tribute is sometimes credited to Philip Brooks, who wrote the hymn, O Little Town of Bethlehem. He was born in an obscure village, the child of a peasant woman. He grew up in another village where he worked in a carpenter shop until he was 30. Then for 3 years he was an itinerant preacher. He never wrote a book. He never held an office. He never had a family or owned a home. He didn't go to college. He never visited a big city. He never traveled 200 miles from the place where he was born. He did none of the things that usually accompany greatness. He had no credentials but himself. He was only 33 when the tide of public opinion turned against him. His friends ran away. One of them denied him. He was turned over to his enemies and went through the mockery of a trial. He was nailed to a cross between two thieves. And while he was dying, his executioners gambled for his garments, the only property that he had on earth. When he was dead, he was laid in a borrowed grave through the pity of a friend. 19 centuries have come and gone, and today he is still the central figure of the human race. All the armies that have ever marched, all the navies that have ever sailed, all the parliaments that have ever sat, all the kings that have ever reigned, put together, have not affected the life of man on this earth as much as this one solitary life. Our next point in looking at the rise of Christianity is the fact that Christianity was and is intolerant of some views, which was at that time and still today a very unpopular concept. You see, it was common ideology and practice in the Roman world to tolerate tolerate and sometimes even accommodate varying elements of society. The historian Edward Gibbon observed that in the world of the Caesars, most different and even hostile nations embraced or at least respected each other's superstitions. The Christians, however, did not go with the flow. They flexed their spiritual muscles, and they would not bow to the pressures of paganism. They taught that the truth was associated exclusively, Acts chapter 4, verses 11 and 12, with Jesus of Nazareth. Theirs was a one Lord, one faith system, Ephesians chapter 4. You see, the Christians drew a line in the sand that they would not compromise. The popular religions of the Roman society catered to the worst, the basest of human passions. For example, in Corinth, 1,000 priestesses or slave girls of the temple of Aphrodite were employed in religious harlotry, which was one of the city's chief sources of revenue. But you know, Christianity then went against society. Christianity forbade all sexual activity except that authorized within the bounds of a monogamous heterosexual marriage. Paul's first letter to the Corinthians emphasizes that repeatedly. How is it possible that Christianity could challenge this licentious lifestyle and still be so successful? Isn't that something you hear today? I've had that conversation with people in this audience before. Isn't it true that today we say, well, you know, people just don't want to hear that. They don't want to hear you talking about that. But how could it be? That society was at least as decadent as the society today. The answer is clear. And the answer to all of our questions is clear. It had a power that cannot be explained in human terms. Our last point is this. In looking at the rise of Christianity is this, that it was an unsafe proposition at the time to be a Christian. Being a Christian in the Roman world was very dangerous. Christianity had barely begun when persecution became a bloody reality. The book of Acts represents a stark picture of the violence that was inflicted upon the new believers. Peter and John were imprisoned, Acts chapter 4, 3, as 5:18. Stephen was stoned to death, Acts chapter 7, 54 and following. James was killed with the sword, probably decapitated, Acts chapter 12, and verse 2. Some of the persecution that Paul endured is vividly shown in 2 Corinthians 11, verse 24 and following. Tertullian would later say that the blood of the martyrs was the seed of the kingdom. In AD 112, Pliny, the governor of Bithynia, sent a letter to Emperor Trajan inquiring as how to deal with these Christians. I ask them if they are Christians. If they admit it, I repeat it a second and a third time, threatening capital punishment. If they persist, I sentence them to death. The demanding question through all of this has to be this. Why would thousands of early Christians allow themselves to be so abused, to be stoned, to be decapitated, to be sewn into animal skins and thrown to wild beasts, to be crucified, to be burned alive? Was it all for a myth? Was it all for some religious hunch? Maybe he's right. Maybe he is who he claims to be. Could it have been that? We started by saying that every effect must have an adequate cause. What possible natural explanation is there for the success of the early church? no theory, grounded strictly in natural, ordinary events, can explain it. You simply can't do it. What is reasonable is this. Those early believers had witnessed the miracles that Jesus and His apostles performed. They carefully examined the evidence, and that they knew that no person could work these signs unless empowered by God. John chapter 3, verse 1 and 2. The Lord Himself had been raised from the dead, and many of these witnesses had observed Him during that 40-day span between the resurrection and His ascension back into heaven. Acts chapter 1, 1 through 3. It was upon this, these well-established historical facts, that the Christian movement was born. Its beginning and expansion were guided by the hand of God. There is no other explanation for it. So what does that mean to us? How do we apply this to our lives today? The first thing that we can learn from this is this, that we can have confidence in what the Word of God teaches. It means that we can grow even if others consider us to be a sect or a cult, like the Jews in the first century thought of Christianity. It means that it is possible with committed people to take the gospel to all creation. It means that even in Granby, Missouri, or Neosho, or Fort Worth, or wherever you're from, all of them being very unlikely places by the world's standards, that we can be a religious stronghold for Christianity. I'm not saying that we need to be like Elijah up on Mount Horeb and living in a cave and say, hey, we're the only ones left. Folks, there are faithful people in the world. You can bank on that. That's exactly the lesson God was teaching Elijah there in 1 Kings chapter 19. It means that no matter how unpopular the truth becomes in this country or the rest of the world, that we can proclaim it and not be ashamed to call ourselves Christians. The early Christians weren't. It means that no matter how dangerous it becomes to be a Christian, that you can be up to the task. You can live up to that expectations others have before you. It means that we can be just like those early Christians, that we can face severe persecution and death, and we can face it with the determination to remain true to our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. We talk about this all the time. Do we want there to be a Christian explosion like there was in the first century? I hope you do. Because God doesn't want anybody to perish, should we? If so, then you and I need to be willing to do what the early church did. We need to be willing to go where the early church went. We need to be willing to say what the early church said. And we need to be willing to face what the early church faced. If you and I are willing, we too can be part of something that will defy any natural explanation, because God will be with us. And with God's help, Philippians 4:13, we can do anything. If it be the case this morning that you understand that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, that you have sins in your life that you must rid yourselves of, that you're willing to confess before this audience that Christ is the Son of God and that you want to be baptized for the remission of sins, if you have this understanding, you can do that this very morning. If you're a Christian who has strayed away, perhaps you might have forgotten what an awesome family that you were added to when you were baptized. If you want to re-energize your spiritual batteries because of some fault of your own, and you need the prayers of this congregation, we can help you with that as well. Won't you come now? Whatever your need is, as we stand and as we sing.